Welcome, everybody. I think we can start. We don't have to make it a quarter past this. The Germans are 1-2. Timely beginning. Welcome to all of you. My name is Nikolai Sinai. I'm a lecturer in Islamic studies at the Oriental Institute, and I'm honored to have been asked to act as the facilitator for today's conversation after having been here yesterday and having listened to your first lecture. In a sense, as opposed to yesterday, there's very little left to say. I don't have a list of thank yous to run through, nor does our distinguished speaker, I think, need an introduction. Although for those of you who may not have been here yesterday, I will say that Professor Filali Ansari is the founding director of the Aga Khan Institute for the Muslim for the Study of Muslim Civilizations, and he's of course also a prolific author and a prominent intellectual. I assume you all know that, because otherwise you would probably not be here. The theme of yesterday's lecture was to resist apologetics, in a nutshell, and today's lecture will, as I gather from Professor Filali Ansari's abstract, acquaint us with a positive alternative to the apologetic mindset that was criticized yesterday. And this alternative, Professor Filali Ansari, again based on the abstract which has been kindly made accessible to me, this alternative our speaker proposes to call liberal Islam, by which he understands, amongst other things, a willingness to engage critically with the Islamic heritage. Of course, this contrast between an apologetic and a critical approach to one's heritage is a fascinating issue to explore. So I might be forgiven for very briefly developing one point that was made at the end of yesterday's lecture in order to get us sort of warmed up for the main act, perhaps. Now, Professor Filali Ansari argued that it's a characteristic feature of the apologetic mindset to project contemporary convictions and values onto one's normative past, onto one's normative texts, scripture, for example. So, for example, someone who finds social justice important might be tempted to see the Quran and Muhammad's ministry as perfect expressions of social justice, or someone who is attracted to constitutionalism might project his notion of constitutional rule onto the Quranic notion of shura, of consultation. Now, when Ali Abd al-Razik argues that Muhammad didn't really set out to found a state, but only to found a religious community, one might be forgiven for asking with, I think it was Judith Pfeiffer yesterday who raised that question, whether that isn't also an exercise in retrojecting contemporary values, namely secularism, onto the normative past. I mean, even if we grant that Muhammad didn't promulgate political institutions or a constitution, it seems hard to deny that the Prophet did, after all, wield political authority of some sort. I mean, he led his adherents into battle against the Meccans. Of course, that is by no means a compelling refutation of Ali Abd al-Razik's sophisticated argument. I mean, there's considerable wiggle room here. One might reply, for example, and I think that's what Ali Abd al-Razik actually does, that the seemingly political actions of Muhammad, they were really just historical necessary means to an end, rather than an end in themselves, that should still be regarded as binding today. On the other hand, I do suspect that such a distinction between means and ends would turn out to be primarily based on ideological considerations. We will be tempted to identify as ends those aspects of the Quran that we, from our contemporary vantage point, regard as ideologically convenient, and dismiss the rest as means that are not anymore binding. All of this makes me wonder whether a properly critical approach to one's religious heritage then wouldn't consist in acknowledging that this heritage may turn out to contain aspects that we, from our contemporary vantage point, might find unsettling, alien, perhaps even trivial, rather than try to assimilate that that heritage to our own set of values, rather than trying to construct a domesticated interpretation of that heritage, so to speak. So in the case of a Muslim reader of the Quran, for example, such a stance might well involve acknowledging that in certain parts of the Quran, Muhammad's religious and political functions do indeed blend into each other, whether we like it or not, whether or not it jars with a secularly minded reader. In the case of a Christian reader of the New Testament, because I think it's a general problem which isn't peculiar to Islam, such a stance might involve acknowledging that Jesus isn't really a wandering Socrates teaching universal moral insights, but an apocalyptic preacher whose view of the world is starkly different from our own. So in both cases, the heritage would turn out to jar with things that we might happen to hold very dearly. So maybe a truly critical, non-apologetic engagement with one's scripture, and we'll hear more about that during the course of the lecture, would above all consist in that ability to sort of look one's historical self in the eye, and unflinchingly look it in the eye, to acknowledge that that self is an inconvenient sort of inhabitant of one's historical identity. Now the further question which arises from that, of course, is whether such a stance is really a realistic option at a time when the values to which a society or religion is committed are themselves being intensely renegotiated and debated, as has been the case in much of the Islamic world over the last two centuries. All of this is very difficult stuff, so I'm very relieved to be able to stop at this inconclusive point and hand over the difficult task of clarifying the contours of what a liberal, critical Islam looks like to the expert hands of our speaker. I'm very much looking forward to the protagonists that we'll be meeting tonight, and I'm sure that just like Averroes and Ali Abdelrazak, they'll in a sense go home with us and carry on their conversation with each other and with us in our minds. So please, may I ask you to welcome our speaker.
Thank you very much for this introduction and for the challenge it offers to me from the outset. I will try to resist the idea of responding immediately, because I want first to give an idea of the historical background for what I would like to introduce today. It seems to me that it would be quite important to take stock, or to have just some idea of what introduced, what prepared the kind of reactions, of thoughts, and of propositions that we are labeling today as part of liberal Islam. So I will begin maybe by saying a few things about the 19th century in the Muslim world, about the fact that it was, what I would stress to start with, is that there is something like an age of discovery in the history of Europe, maybe in the 16th or 17th century, where Europeans were discovering some parts of the world they didn't know before, and so on, and discovering other peoples, other cultures, other religions, and so on. The 19th century has been more or less, for Muslims, to take the expression by a historian, and also an age of discovery, but of discovery of the discoverers, if I could say. They discovered Europe in the 19th century, which doesn't mean that they didn't have interactions with Europe before. They did have interactions, and these were continuous and took various forms. But in the 19th century, it was a great revelation for many Muslim societies to discover that something important had been happening in Europe, that Europeans had changed a lot, that they had a much greater military might, a much better technology, that they had, if I can say, that the relationship between the societies of the southern and eastern Mediterranean and Europe had completely, the balance of power between the two had completely changed. And well, there were a number of events of early in the 19th century, maybe even before the Napoleon campaign in Egypt is just before the happened just before the 19th century, and there were also other similar events by which European colonialists came to various parts of what was the Muslim world, to the subcontinent, with the British, to the to Indonesia by the Dutch, to sub-Saharan Africa, to North Africa by the French, and so on. And that was, if I can say, an age of great surprise and great discovery for many Muslims. And there was also something that happened at that time which must be borne in mind. The fact that there were a number of travelers from the Muslim world who went to Europe and came back with narratives about the surprising things they were seeing. One of those narratives has been translated into French under an interesting title, Le paradis des femmes et l'enfer des chevaux. It's the relation of a Moroccan ambassador to France who was very surprised by the way Europeans treated women and treated horses at the same time, which was, to his taste, quite opposite to the way Muslims were used to do in their own contexts. One of such travelers who had an immense influence on his contemporaries was an Egyptian called Rifa'a Tahtawi, who went to Paris. He was more or less the contemporary of Alexis de Tocqueville. When Alexis de Tocqueville was visiting the US, a few years earlier than the accomplished by Alexis de Tocqueville in America, Rifa'a Tahtawi was in Paris. And there is Alexis de Tocqueville wrote his famous book, Democracy in America, where he was introducing to his fellow Frenchmen or Europeans something that was new, that was happening in America. Democracy had, if I can say, began to take shape or to take specific shapes in that context, while Europe was still at the age of revolutions, and so especially France. So he was, in a way, bringing back home news about some positive developments that were unknown in his own country. Well, in more or less similar ways, Rifa'a Tahtawi wrote a book, it's translated under the title of The Gold of Paris. So he was also introducing his own people to something that he discovered in Paris. He was, in fact, Tahtawi was also a cleric trained in the traditional religious way, like Ali Abdelrazik much later. And he was sent to Paris as a companion to a number of students who were placed at schools of artillery in Paris to learn how to use guns and so on. But during the 3 or 4 years he spent in Paris, he learned French and he read the French paper, and he happened to be there in 1848. A very important moment in the French history, and he had interesting things to say, and his book has become also a kind of classic in the contemporary in Arab literature, in the same way that Democracy in America has become classic in its own way. So it was an age of discovery. And the two things, in my opinion, can be said about the reactions that prevailed at that time within Muslim contexts. One of them was the feeling that they needed to do something, to correct something about the understanding of their own heritage. They discovered that colonialists, the French expeditions in Africa, the Dutch in Indonesia, and so on, had been observing the practices, the popular practices in Muslim contexts, and that they were overwhelmed by observations about, for example, the cult of saints, local saints, about a number of practices that belong to what now we call popular religion. They also had a lot to say about superstition, about fanatism, about fatalism of Muslims and so on. And those early intellectuals, those who went to Europe and had a direct contact with Europe, felt the need, if I can say, to separate what is normative Islam from what became accretions in their opinions, what was added by popular practice. So it is from then one can say that a clear distinction was felt to be needed between popular and normative Islam, with popular practices, what one can observe. And again, I come back to this quotation from Cantwell Smith that I mentioned yesterday. They were not recognizing themselves in the image that Europeans were having about Europe. So the first of these thinkers had the reflex of trying to correct this image, of to saying, well, what you have been observing, what you have been witnessing, what you have seen the people doing is not the true Islam, is not what Islam teaches. These are practices that have emerged in various contexts. These are ways of and means of ignorant people, people who ignore about the tenets and the teachings of Islam and so on, and who are indulging in some local customs or local traditions, many of which have nothing to do with the real Islam. So this first wave of reactions, which is labeled nowadays by historians as reformist Islam. It has some great names like Jamaluddin al-Afghani, who was an Iranian, who at that time traveled a lot around the Muslim world, went to Istanbul, to Cairo, to Tehran and so on, and tried to mobilize the leaders at that time. They were feeling that something important, that a great breach had happened in the balance of power between Muslim polities and the European powers at that time. Well, just a quick reminder that until the 16th century, maybe the greatest powers on the world stage were three empires. All three of them were Muslim. To the west, there was the Ottoman Empire. In the center, there was the Qajar Empire, which was in Iran. And to the east, there was the Mughal Empire in the subcontinent. These were labeled as the gunpowder empires, and they were seen until the 16th century as the main powers on the world stage. So just two centuries later, these began to be seen as the sick men of there, and they were on the decline until early on in the 20th century, they dissolved and left the space or to states of a new shape, of a new kind of state, the modern state. But for these early thinkers like Jamaluddin al-Afghani and so on, the decline that they were witnessing had a clear cause, and they could identify the reason for which these Muslim polities and Muslim societies had lost in the competition with Europe. It was the fact that they abandoned the tenets of the faith, the sobriety of the faith, the simplicity of the faith, and had indulged in practices that were corrupt, that were popular, that were based on ignorance and so on. And this, if I can say, this reaction against popular religious practices is something that remained and had deep influence that we feel until now. Popular Islam was suspected from the outset, from early on in the 19th century, to be at the origin of all the ills, all the problems, all the issues that were faced by Muslims. And there is these early reformists which tried, were apologetic in a way. They didn't accept the facts as they were. they thought of a normative Islam as a, they thought of rather Islam how in their opinion it ought to be, to take the expression of Cromwell Smith. So it's a normative view that they advocated, that they advocated first against Europeans who were discovering and writing and working on Muslim societies, but also reflecting to in the direction of their own societies. They were stressing that that was not the true Islam, and that one they had to go back to normative Islam. So what this going back to normative Islam is something that has been very influential. It has permeated all nationalist movements, and when nationalist movements began to resist or to react to European colonialism, the one of their main fields or areas of action was resisting or fighting popular religious expressions. And this one finds, and this topic or this attitude or this kind of reaction has remained very strong and has been continuous and has had many expressions, one of them being what we are calling nowadays, one extreme form of them, what we are calling nowadays Salafism. So it's this rejection of popular Islam that has been influential, and I want to stress it from the outset. This is, this generation of reformist thinkers had, well, as great names, the two that are most often mentioned are Jamal Din al-Afghani, who was an Iranian, as I said, who has written little, but who has made a great influence on many of those who were to write later. The other name, the other one who was very prominent in this direction was Muhammad Abduh, an Egyptian, who became a theologian, who was very influent in his own country, who was very influent across the Muslim world. He died in 1905, and his works include a new commentary of the Quran, and his main ideas was that there is nothing of, if I can say, about Islam that can be labeled as fanaticism or fatalism or superstition, that Islam is a rational religion, it's a sober monotheism, and so on. And these values have to be stressed again and again. There was another reaction which prevailed, and to which I will come back on Thursday, which also had a great influence since then in a Muslim context. It's a fascination with the kind of order that was discovered in European societies. This we find in Tahtawi. Well, Tocqueville was fascinated by democracy in America. Tahtawi was fascinated by the order in European societies, by the respect for order, by also what came to be known as constitutionalism. Constitutionalism became, in Muslim context, the emblem of the good political order. In a way, many were saying it, well, maybe not as bluntly as I'm going to say it, what Islam was about has been reached by Europeans in different ways. Europeans, someone has said, had been practicing Islam without even being aware of that. That they had been real more or closer to implementing Muslim ideals of what a Muslim society ought to be than had Muslim societies. So it is said, I'm not sure that it is historical true, that someone said it in these words, I went to Europe and found Islam without Muslims, and came back to the Muslim world and found Muslims without Islam. So, but this is maybe just a caricature of the way it was felt. The most important thing to keep in mind here is the fascination with constitutionalism. And it has great impact, and it is still also with us. It is one layer, one important layer in the way people have been understanding and thinking about the norms and how to implement them in society, in history. So we have these reactions in the 19th century. They led to the emergence or to strengthening the apologetics, what I described yesterday as apologetics in Muslim context. It's the idea of defending all good values under the banner of Islam. They led also some of engaging in what I would call cherry picking in the heritage. This is something that you are more or less saying to me, and I'll come back to react to it. It's the idea of finding in the scriptures what one thinks are good things and ignoring the rest. For example, many feminists were pointing to some verses of the Quran which clearly state that there is a kind of spiritual equality between men and women, and so on. And they forget about the other verses about marriage, about polygamy, about divorce, and so on. So there's this attitude of selective readings, and many have gone for it in one direction or the other. And this is one of the reasons for which there is a feeling of weakness in the attitudes of liberals. I'll come back later. There was also something very interesting, an episode that was described by a contemporary scholar, by a German historian. His name is Reinhard Schulze. He is the only one who has written a comprehensive history of modern or contemporary Muslim societies. He covered the whole 20th century and covered the whole of Muslim societies from Central Asia to Nigeria, from Indonesia to Morocco, and tried to look at the main currents, the main trends that were driving change in those contexts. And very early in his book, he identified something that he finds to have played a very important role, that he labels or describes as code switching. Code switching is an expression which is used by linguists. It refers to a practice by which people go from one language to another, that when sometimes they begin to speak in a language, this is something that I do all the time, that since English is not my main working language, one feels the need to go back to another language. Well, he used this expression to refer to something that had great popularity or great following early in the 20th century. It was to label a number of values that came from Europe with Muslim names. For example, as you pointed out, to say that democracy, in fact, is Shura. It's what the Quran refers to as Shura, this idea that anyone who is in a position of leadership over a community has to take into account the feelings, the opinions, the attitudes of those who are under his or her authority. So, and that was for Schulze, it was a means for those societies to appropriate values of modernity, to appropriate human rights, democracy, all what made the freedoms of the individual and so on. Although on the idea of freedom there is a case which is stressed again and again by Bernard Lewis. Whenever he has an interview, he refers to that. This Rifa'at Tahtawi, whom I mentioned a little earlier, who was in Paris in 1848, while he was learning French, was perplexed by something. He found that there was a word that came all the time in the French press. And when the word could be found in dictionaries, there were not many French and Arabic dictionaries at that time, but there were at least some. and he could find it, but the explanation provided by dictionaries was not working. The word is liberté, liberty. And what he found, well, for him, liberté was a legal term, which describes the status of someone who is not a slave. So people were either slaves or freemen. So what does freedom come to do in the picture? He was puzzled, and after a few weeks or a few months, he had, well, Eureka, he found out. Well, liberté had to be translated by adala. For those who know Arabic, adala is the Arabic word for justice. So what Bernard Lewis concludes from this is that Muslims were living in, if I can say, a different conceptual world. They had no equivalent to the freedoms, to the idea of political freedom as it had emerged and developed in Europe. So their language, they couldn't find, even when they found values that they appreciated, the political freedom and so on, they had no way of expressing them. So they had recourse. They went to their own heritage. I am not sure that Bernard Lewis is right, has really understood what Rifaat Atawi was saying. My impression, I went back to the paragraphs where Tahtawi mentions this. My impression is that Tahtawi understood very well the difference between the legal and the political meanings of liberty, but was saying to his people in Egypt that the values that Muslims put under the label of justice, while Europeans put them under the label of freedom. But in fact, it's acknowledging the some basic rights of every individual, and the Muslims think of this acknowledgement of these basic rights as a form of justice. And so it was not a misunderstanding or a mistranslation by him, but nevertheless, there was, if I can say, a large movement. And following Schulze, had this worked, well, modernization would have been much easier in Muslim context. But this didn't work. And it didn't work, first of all, says Schulze again, because Europeans rejected this kind of practice. They were insisting, well, all those who were aware of what was being done rejected the assimilation of what they thought was their heritage. Democracy was a European thing. Freedom, political freedom, equality of gender equality or women's rights, and all these values were seen as being Western, as having their roots, for example, in ancient Greece and so on. And it was signified that these are not ways to say what these values were, in fact. So that brought this great movement to some kind of abrupt end. At some moment, it was not possible. It was no more possible. And in a way, Muslims were pushed back to their own heritage and to trying to, and this is what Schulze is saying. I'm not sure that we can follow him 100% in this, but he is insisting on this. So I maybe have taken too much time about the historical background, because what I want to come to, my main point, is what is labeled liberal Islam. And let me say from the outset that liberal Islam is not an object that people agree on. It's a label. And it's not a label that many are happy with, that many are comfortable with. Some have used other labels. Modernist Islam, for example. Some has said progressist Islam. Jacques Berck has said Islam de modernité, Islam of modernity. And we have, because it's not one object, it's not one trend, one current that can be identified as such It's rather a collection, number of individuals who happen to converge. And the surprising, the remarkable thing is that they have all these individuals, there's a large number of them, have all emerged more or less at the same time in different contexts without communication between them. There's an American scholar, his name is Charles Kurtzman, and he is the one who has chosen this label of liberal Islam. He has published an anthology, a book in which he has translated into English a number of excerpts from writings of those he calls liberal Muslims. And in his anthology, in fact, there are tens of them, nearly. I didn't count them exactly, I should have done that, but this can be repaired quite quickly. There are a large number of them, and they happen to have emerged at the same time in Central Asia, in Indonesia, in India, in Egypt, in the Sudan, in North Africa, in Sub-Saharan Africa, everywhere, and all have, if I can say, something in common. They all question the master narrative. It's not their idea, the difference between them and the reformists of the 19th and early 20th century is that they are not trying to identify what is the proper Islam, what is the correct Islam, the normative Islam. They are reacting against the master narrative, against the way Muslims have been understanding their own heritage, their own religion, their own history. And many of them, I yesterday mentioned just two of them, and the two that I have chosen to for my presentation yesterday happen to be two individuals who have not been exposed to modern scholarship, to European ideas and so on. I was reminded that Ali Abd al-Razik did in fact come to Oxford, that the one I mentioned yesterday, that he began to study here in Oxford, that he enrolled in English courses and in a program about economics. But he had to leave before, after a few weeks or a few months, because World War I had begun, and he felt that he needed to go back home. So he never completed his studies, and I am quite sure that he never had access. He mentions in his essay that I discussed yesterday, he had a footnote which with a reference to a book by Thomas Arnold about the Caliphate, a book that had been translated into Arabic. But in the whole of his reasoning, there is no trace of any influence from modern scholarship. So, but in fact, the others who are on my list, I will maybe look at one or two or maybe three examples, have been exposed to modern scholarship. And here, I would like to open a very quick parenthesis. Is it the right way to say it in English? Very small one. It's the fact that modern social science is something much more recent than we have a tendency to think. That, for example, modern ways of writing history is, the modern history is a discipline that was born and is prevailing just since the late 18th and 19th century. That, well, for example, society has been an important object of reflection for philosophers in the 17th, 18th century. But the first sociologists proper date from late 19th century. Max Weber, Emil Durkheim, and so on. So these new disciplines are very recent. And they have come to shape our understanding of history, of society, of politics, of everything human, but we tend to forget that. So this wave, if I can say, of new disciplines emerging came also to touch or to reach the understanding of Muslim traditions. It came in the form of what was labeled later on as Orientalism. It was, if I can say, Emil Durkheim and Max Weber and so on were thinking, it was they were from thinking from the inside, the changes in their own societies, what was happening in, they were themselves Europeans. The first similar works on the heritage of Muslims was done from the outside by Orientalists, by people who were discovering, and as I said yesterday, who were looking rather at the facts of Muslim societies. And when the works of these Orientalists came to be known in Muslim contexts, there was a great feeling of shock, because what was presented were, again, facts about society, not the norms. They were discussing about or studying the practices of Muslim societies here and there, and they were selecting sometimes their facts. They were also ignoring some facts and so on. And that the controversy about Orientalism was a great moment in recent scholarship in the West, but within Muslim context, it was something much bigger than that. It was, and this is not, has to be acknowledged, the reaction against Orientalism. Nearly every contemporary thinker had to write his or her essay against Orientalism. And this fed a lot into apologetics in its way, because people went from one extreme to the other. I would say Orientalism, in some of its expressions, was also a kind of apologetics. It's but apologetics against, if I can say, or rather reductive. They were using, some of those scholars were using, were trying also to justify some attitudes, some European attitudes about the other peoples, about their inferiority, about their backwardness, about things like that. So all this was felt very strongly. Nevertheless, there were a number of individuals, and this is what is remarkable about them, that stepped back from all this and tried, if I can say, to look at the big picture and came with some interesting ideas. As I said, if you look at the book by Charles Goldsman, you'll find maybe 40 or 50 names, and one could easily add to his list. There are names that he couldn't in any way do cover all those thinkers. There are, as I said, 40 or 50 names. Among them, there are some who had the ability, who had the reflex of trying to step back from the controversy between apologetics and Orientalism, if I can say, about the extremes, and to look with a critical eye at the heritage. I'll go through maybe, as I said, two or three in cases. One of them, a very interesting one, maybe the only one who was at the origin of a kind of religious movement. Let me say again, before coming to those names, that we witness since the 18th century in the whole Muslim world and the emergence of a number of religious movements. Wahhabism, that is quite often mentioned today, dates from the 18th century. And since then, there were a number of movements that mobilized large numbers. There was Mahdism, for example, what is called Mahdism in the Sudan. There was the Sanusiya in what is now Libya. There were Tablighi Jama'at in what is now the Indian subcontinent and so on. It's against a background of a number of movements which all tried to go back to some understanding of normative Islam against popular Islam in order to mobilize the population against colonialism, against backwardness, against underdevelopment and so on. Muslim Brotherhood being one of those movements. But against that background, you have these individuals who tried something else, who went in an altogether different direction. I would like to stress one or two, as I said, or maybe two or three cases. The first one is Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, This is a Sudanese who has been trained as an engineer. And he was born in 1909 and was executed for heresy in 1985. His idea, his book is entitled The Second Message of Islam. And it is translated into English. And he has a disciple now who teaches in the US, who is very prominent and very well known. And his idea is a very strong one, and a very appealing one. Muslims, as well as historians in general, acknowledge that in the career of Prophet Muhammad, in his lifetime, there are two phases which are very clearly distinguished and acknowledged as two different phases. There is what is called the Meccan phase, and there is the Medinan phase. Mecca is the city where the Prophet was born and where he lived and where he began his mission and his teachings and his preaching, if I can say. And for 10 years he preached to his people, but was ridiculed, persecuted in various ways and so on, and had a very small following. And during this phase, the revelations that he received were surahs of the Quran, which are generally very short and had proclaimed, if I can say, the principles of a pure monotheism, principles of a very austere ethical way of life and things like that. No regulations in Mecca. It is when the Prophet afterwards emigrated to Medina, to another city, that a new phase began in his life, where he was acknowledged as the leader of the community. And this is why our friends are saying that he did have some political role to play. He was acknowledged by the tribes which lived in Medina as a leader, as a prophet. And it is from then that the revelation, the tone, the style, the length of the surahs, of the chapters of the Quran change completely, and we have the commandments, the regulations about various aspects of life, about, mainly personal morality, personal hygiene, rules by which a Muslim should be living. So, what Mahmoud Taha stresses is that most Muslims have been accepting, have been taking on the idea of the primacy of the chronological order. The last verses of the Quran prevail over the early ones. So this is the idea that has been accepted by all, or nearly all, Muslim denominations, that it is the latest surahs, especially when sometimes they made changes to things that were said before, that were authoritative. This idea of abrogation became a main topic of Islamic theology. How abrogation, how the Quran, some verses abrogate others. And it's the idea that the chronological order, the latest, are the ones that should be followed, that are authoritative. In fact, says Mahmoud Taha, this is wrong. Because what we have in Mecca, we are the principles. And what we have in Medina is an implementation, a historical implementation. We have the principles which are universal, which claim the dignity of man and woman, which don't go into details about marriage or inheritance or whatever, but they claim the main, if I can say, foundations of a new religious way of looking at things, or new religious worldviews. So the primacy should be acknowledged to the principles, not to the historical implementation, to the experiment that went on in Medina and by which the Prophet attempted to create the moral community that he was tasked with within some specific constraints. He could not achieve everything. He could not do all what he could do, and so on. So he had striven to change the order, to change the prevailing customs. We were mentioning the case of the status of women yesterday. He found out that women were treated as goods, that they were inherited part of the inheritance of any man. He made of them rather human, well, persons who have a share in the heritage, so they could not be inherited themselves. This is a big change, that, and things like that. So his idea is that Muslims should discard this attitude that has prevailed for centuries among theologians, to give primacy to, or authority to, the latest verses, and rather accept, go back to that Islam had in fact for him two messages. One was immediate, which was the experiment of Medina, the model of Medina, but another which was behind it, which was the principles that were laid down in the earlier revelations and that were universal, that had to be implemented in different ways, in more appropriate ways later. This idea was felt to be a great one, and he is among all those whom we could label liberal Muslims, the one who had really popular following. He created a political party which was very anti-monarchist, if I can say. It was called the Republicans, and he had until a despot took power in a coup in Sudan, Ja'far al-Numeiri. And this is something that maybe I'll come back to at the conclusion. There was a kind of situation where solidarity was could be put in place between despotism and conservative Muslim clerics. Of course, conservative Muslim clerics found that the discourse of Mahmud Taha was unacceptable. They labeled him as heretic, and immediately the despot stepped in and took the heretic, and his trial lasted 2 hours. And after 2 hours, he was declared as heretic, and he was already quite an old man, 76 years, and he had hanged, and there was a strong repression against his movement. So this is one of those liberal Muslims. Another one example, if I may, Mahmud Taha was not a scholar in any way. He was in fact trained as an electric engineer, and he was working in train companies and things like that. So although his intuition or his view is a very strong one, but the one that I'm going to mention now is a proper scholar. His name is Fazlur Rahman. He is originally from India, and his writings in English are available and are very good reads, if I may suggest them. There is one of them called entitled Islam and Second Edition. It's one of the best introductions to Islam by a scholar, a solid scholar, but to some degree conservative one. He was from a family, from a lineage of Islamic scholars and so on. And his idea, which is shared by many others in different ways, is that from the outset, the heritage of Muslims or the message of Islam has been taken in the wrong direction. The fact is, for him, the early clerics have taken the scriptures as a means to build new regulations, and they did that in ways which are not, if I can say, the best to capture the spirit and the meanings and the teachings of the new religion. They took the teachings of the Quran as atomic units. He insists on this word of atomistic approach to the heritage. Each commandment was an atom, like a unit by itself, and each one could be used as a yardstick in order to design or to create new rulings. So those early clerics or those early Muslim thinkers were going from one particular case to another particular case, one particular rule to another particular rule, without going to the principle which laid beyond or behind those rules. They didn't try to understand the overview, the ethical worldview that was there, that was proposed. They just took the rulings as yardsticks and used them to create new examples, and piled up all those examples and sacralized those units without the spirits, the spirit that was behind them. And so if I can say, it was a bad turn from the outset. And he has severe words against the early ones and against the whole tradition, and thinks that the first task that has to be undertaken is to think of the Quranic ethic, and he dedicated his life to this, and attempted to. At some point in Pakistan, the ruler called on him and asked him to lead an institution which was tasked with rethinking education about the heritage, rethinking the way Islam is understood, is taught in schools, and the way it is used to regulate society. And he began to work in that institute, and this is where he wrote a book entitled Islam and Modernity, where he used an expression which seems to me to be very appropriate, to be one of the best to describe what has been happening in Muslim contexts. He said that what the greatest challenge that contemporary Muslim societies are facing is the educational system about the heritage. The education about the heritage is delivered following approaches which are obsolete, which are, if I can say, medieval, well, this is a bad way to say it, which do not acknowledge history as it happened, which leave aside a number of things about the heritage, which perpetuate the kind of very closed-mindedness about religion in a mechanical ways from one generation to the other. He called this the most vicious of all vicious circles. I really like this way of describing things, because it seems to me to be a very accurate description. What we see in these madrasa systems, as they are called nowadays, is a form of religious education which replicates methods, approaches, and so on, based on late and narrow interpretations. And the people who are trained in this system are training others, and it seems so difficult now to break the circle, to bring new ways of teaching about. There are a number of attempts or experiments that are undertaken nowadays here and there in the Muslim world, but the wave, and I'll come back to this, is that the great wave is a return to traditional education, which ignores, which rejects, by ignoring, by totally not noticing all what these new disciplines, the human sciences, the humanities, the new way of writing history, sociology, the understanding of religions, comparative religions, and all that. It's really the main source. It feeds into apologetics in the strongest ways, and the consequences of such a system are quite visible to anyone who wants to look at those societies. So, Fazlur Rahman, who was the author of this expression, could not stay in his day. He was also persecuted. He was not executed as was Mahmud Taha, but he had to flee Pakistan in dramatic conditions. And he ended his life as a professor in Chicago. And his late works, maybe you have known him, Guy. But I didn't have the luck of meeting him before he died. But many of my colleagues did have that luck. He is someone who is at the same time deeply religious, but also very lucid, very critical. And he has some good pieces against apologetics in one side and Orientalism on the other side. He is the one who attempted to find some way of dealing with the heritage in intelligent ways. I could mention many others. Maybe the latest is someone who died just 2 years ago, Muhammad Arkun. He has lectured so widely in the world. And he was a friend of mine, but he had what seemed to me quite a paradoxical attitude, because he wanted at the same time to be a very rigorous scholar, abiding only by the rules of modern scholarship, but wanted at the same time to be heard and to be influential in Muslim contexts. His language was not something that was easy to understand, even to scholars. So what to say about the people in Muslim context? But he still, all his life, was a kind of militant, of a fighter, who was going everywhere, teaching everywhere, lecturing, and making the great arguments. And his writings are with us about these new ways of looking at the heritage. Before him, there are maybe two other names that can be highlighted or ought to be highlighted. There is an Iranian who is called Abdul Karim Sorush, who is alive, who is, he's probably in the US in the moment. He too had to, if I can say, to take refuge out of his country. And again, for Sorush, very briefly, the idea, what he proposes, is that maybe Islam is a kind of noumen, like a Kantian noumen, but understandings of Islam are various and multiple, and it is legitimate for each period, for each generation, for each context, to generate its own new understanding of what Islam is. And we are not, no generation is bound by the reading of previous generations. This is in very few words, with the biggest brushes, that can be what Sorosh has been teaching. Another one who is a friend of mine and who is one of the most lucid individuals is a Tunisian called Abdel Majid Sharfi. He is the one who has written recently a book with a very telling title, Islam Between Message and History. This is the distinction I was stressing yesterday, Islam between message and history. The idea that there is great need for Muslims to, if I can say, put order in what the way they understand their heritage, to put what belongs to the message, to the religion, to Islam, or the equivalent of Christianity, as I said yesterday, on one hand, and on the other hand, what belongs to their history, what various Muslim societies have done with the teachings, and in to avoid this, if I can say, semantic trap, if I can describe it in that way, the fact that we use one word, Islam, to refer to two things, to the message and to what people have done with the message. And he takes one of the main dogmas of Islam, the dogma of the closing of revelation. Do I have a few minutes, or shall I?
You've got more than a few minutes. Actually.
Ah, okay. Well, his idea is that, it is a dogma for Muslims that Prophet Muhammad is the seal of prophecy, is the last prophet in history. And that with the death of Prophet Muhammad, the contact with God comes to an end. That there will be no more, this is why you find so many Muslims angry about or react very badly about those who claim prophecy after Muhammad. The Sikhs, for example, have been persecuted by Muslims, the Ahmadiyya, and so on, just because of that, because they question this dogma of end of revelation. Sharfi stresses that Muslims have taken the end of revelation in one sense, that they understood that the latest, and we find something that was said by Mahmoud Taha as well, that they understand that the latest revelations are the most authoritative, and that Muslims are bound by the very latest verses of the Quran, and they are bound by whatever has been derived from them in their history. For him, it should be reverted. The fact that the revelation comes to an end is a clear signal sent to the humans that humanity does not need revelation anymore. That Islam is ended to be these are not his words, the religion of exit from religion. This is an expression that has been used by a French scholar for Christianity. Marcel Gauchet has used the expression saying that Christianity had been the religion of exit from religion, because Christian theology for him has been involved in detailed theological problems, in difficult theological problems, how to understand the Trinity and so on. And all this struggling with difficult issues has developed a number of reactions, of reflexes, and has pushed the thinking of those Christians into directions where they shed aside religion by itself. Well, Sharfi doesn't say exactly the same thing about Islam, but he says that this dogma is a kind of liberation for mankind. The idea that from now on, after mankind or human societies can rely on themselves, that they had reached the age of maturity, that mankind had reached maturity, and they don't need, if I can say, to abide by their teaching. They now are in a phase where they can understand the lesson from all those revelations, for all those religions, all those prophets. They don't need any more prophets anymore. They can rely on themselves and develop their own ways. This is maybe the latest of Muslim theology that has been proposed, the latest thinking. And his book is published in Arabic and has been translated in French. And I had the pleasure of helping publishing an English translation. So it is available. It is one of the most appealing for me interpretations of the heritage. So to conclude my remarks today, of course, I could mention others. And maybe I'm doing, my selection is, every selection is arbitrary in a way or another. There I could also mention Talbi, to whom I alluded yesterday. I could mention Jabri in Morocco, who has been very brilliant as well. I could have mentioned Al-Hashmawi, and many, many, many others. But I think that I may have given an idea about what these quote and unquote liberal Muslims have been thinking. And I come to the second part of my title, where do we find ourselves now? Well, I stressed at some point that we have these individuals on one hand, and on the other hand, a number of mass movements, like the Muslim Brotherhood, like the Tablighi Jama'at, like... So we have individuals who have been offering very intelligent, very elegant interpretations of the heritage, and very also very critical of the master narrative ways. They have proposed ways, if I can say, to historicize the heritage. And here I will come to your objections, maybe, that to your points, that historicizing or explaining a number of expressions by the conditions where they emerged, by the for example, Fazlur Rahman stresses that the commandments that we find in the Quran are not meant to be a system. Are not, the Quran is not a book of law, and are not meant to be elements of a comprehensive system of regulations. That they were rather responses given to some specific questions that came at those times. So the fact that they were sacralized, that they were taken as ultimate yardsticks out of from which all other rules had to be derived, is built on a big misunderstanding. That why did I mention this? I'm sorry. Fazlur Rahman was insisting on the fact that if we historicize, if we really put these rulings or these commandments in context, we are not betraying them. We are not rejecting these. We are rather going to their spirit. We need to go to the spirit, to the ethical principles which are behind them, rather than stay at the letter and take it as something sacred that has to be implemented. So this shows, in my opinion, the elegance, the way that, well, elegance is a word that is used by French speakers. I'm doing some code switching here, but mostly by it shows how these thinkers have been using knowledge acquired by modern historians in ways that enable to reinterpret the heritage, in ways that enable people to have the comfort of feeling that they are within the limits, or that they are respecting their own traditions, but without being bound by interpretations, by implementations of the past. But where we are now, we have those mass movements which have captured or succeeded in capturing, I will come back to this on Thursday again, have succeeded in capturing the imaginary or the imagination of populations. The Muslim Brotherhood, the Tablighi Jama'at, all those movements have managed in a way to speak a language, to use concepts, to use terms, to use notions that were understood to the populations. And so they could gather in their favor the resentment that the populations had against despots that prevailed in the... And these mass movements are rather conservative. And they are objective allies, if we want to use Marxist terminology, of conservative, of the kind of educational system that is prevailing. So we have the vicious circle, which is strengthened from the outside. It is a vicious circle by itself, because clerics are trained in the same mindset as their trainers, as their educators. And Fazlur Rahman is asking the question, who will re-educate the educators if we want to really change? Can you replace the whole category, the whole class of educators that are practicing at some time or at some age? No, you can't. So how can we get out of this? Well, in fact, maybe things are even worse, because there is a kind of situation where traditional scholarship is felt to be the best ally of non-democratic regimes that happen to prevail in most of the Muslim world. It's much easier for non-democratic power systems to call on established authorities, to call on those clerics who are conservative for their support, to provide support to them. And we find this situation nearly in, well, not all, but in most countries that form part of what is called the Muslim world, a kind of distribution of roles, a kind of solidarity, of understanding between the traditional learning, which conveys, and which conveys interpretations as being the only possible orthodoxy, and so on, and existing regimes. And whenever someone is questioning these interpretations from a scholarly perspective, they are most often persecuted. We have seen an extreme case of someone who was executed. We have seen the case of Fazlur Rahman, who had to leave his country in great panic. We had also Arkun, who was not welcome in his native country at the end. And so this is what I find to be the situation now. We do have, on one hand, a number of individuals who have proposed very intelligent ways, very knowledgeable ways of interpreting heritage, based on scholarship, not based on any kind of apologetics. They are based on critical assessment of the interpretations, and they accept, if I can say, critical discussions. But these are proposed by individuals. These individuals have some following in some circles, in some areas. If you go to Casablanca, for example, and if you organize, when we used to be there and we invited Mohammed Arkun, we did have a full auditorium. We did have 200 or 300 people in the room, and he could speak, and he was very attractive to many people. But beyond that, in the streets, I was once thinking while he was talking, what are people thinking about all that? In the streets, in the 6 million inhabitants of Casablanca, for example, what are they? We had in the room maybe 200 or 300 people, very eager, very willing to listen. But outside the room, what is happening in the city? I would say what is happening is that the traditional learning, traditional scholarship is still prevailing, and nothing seems to be there to challenge it seriously. Thank you very much.